Ladies and gentlemen, as of today, we reach the end of May, and we are in Exodus chapter 23. We started Exodus chapter 20 in December. There are 126 verses in these four chapters, and we've covered 90 of them, averaging only 3.6 verses per week. Back when we were in Genesis, we'd sometimes get more than a chapter done in a week. This week, we will discuss Exodus chapter 23, verses 20 through 33. Adding 14 verses to our total, and leaving behind 22 yet undone. And from there, we're going to move on to a new subject. However, I mention that which is yet undone because I want you to know that we absolutely are not skipping it and leaving it behind. One of the reasons that I started preaching here at East Jordan is because of the opportunity to give a thorough discussion of the scriptures that ordinary churches simply can't give. I've often said that I was rarely ever disappointed in what I heard from the pulpit in most churches, but I was often disappointed by what I did not hear, vast swaths of scripture that never received any due consideration. Well, I don't want you to think that I'm leaving anything out, or that I'm avoiding subjects that might be uncomfortable. So, before we leave Exodus 23, I want to give a brief description of what we're passing and why we're passing it. Then we'll get on with today's message. So, first off, we're skipping some verses that could have been placed in other sermons but weren't. We have a few verses condemning idolatry and the worship of false gods. We had messages on those principles, but we didn't necessarily hit every verse in particular. So I wanted to give them their due recognition while we're here today so that you can note them. We also skipped over several sections of abrogated laws. We aren't skipping these because we're never going to discuss abrogated laws in detail, but because they require a deeper contextual discussion. So, for example, we have laws about holidays, and in studying the holidays, we need to understand the sacrificial offerings made on those holidays. And to understand the offerings, we need to understand the priesthood and the setup of the tabernacle, the altar, and how sacrifices were made, and so forth. And we do have some rules about altars that we skipped, but all of those things are abrogated. We aren't required to keep those holidays or to make those sacrifices or to worship at those altars. That does not make the passages irrelevant, but it does make them of a less immediate importance. But more than that, I want us to make sure that we have a clear context for the entire Israeli system of worship so that we can fully understand what those passages teach. There will be plenty of opportunity for us to get into those concepts later as we go through the end of Exodus and Leviticus. So I'm going to plan to hit those ideas when we get there. We also have a handful of laws that don't necessarily fit anywhere or warrant an entire message of their own. We have a verse about a dietary restriction here, a verse about helping your enemy there, a verse about respecting your rulers, and one about not practicing witchcraft, all of which are important topics, no doubt, but none of them, I expect, I could speak on for a full 15 to 30 minutes, so look for me to plug those verses elsewhere. And of course, while I've tried to give you a thorough understanding of the laws that we've covered so far, we haven't reached all of their possible applications or many other scriptural issues that surround them. Clearly, these have been some deep chapters. I mention all those verses we missed, though, because before we start moving on, I want to note that the laws we have covered, while they are not as fully fleshed out as what we will find moving forward, represent a good overview of the whole law. In preaching through these chapters, we've made references to larger passages throughout the Law of Moses, and in fact, we've already covered over 10% of all the verses between Exodus chapter 20, verse 1, and the end of Deuteronomy. We've talked about most overarching principles that we have to deal with in the modern day, and we've done that without considering dietary restrictions, holidays, the priesthood, and temple worship, all of which are subjects which receive a great deal of attention in the law. We also note that while those topics take up a great deal of space, much of the remainder of the law will also be devoted to narratives. Israel rebels against Moses, Israel wanders off in the wilderness, Balaam is sent to curse the people, Israel defeats the kings east of the Jordan, the deaths of Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, and so forth. So, while we still have much to cover in the Law of Moses, I want you to see that right from the beginning of their wanderings, right here at Mount Sinai, God has given to his people a fairly comprehensive bird's-eye view of his moral principles. If you want to understand moral living and governance, as well as Israeli worship, these two or three pages that we've been studying for the last 6 months are an excellent place to start. Later, these laws will be more fleshed out as the people of Israel wander the wilderness. But what we will continue to read is in no way a change to these original laws. What we will read going forward is simply further instructions on the proper application of these laws, and that includes the priesthood and the sacrifices and so forth, as we will eventually study. So, now we've dispensed with that. Today's passage for consideration will be Exodus chapter 23, verses 20 through 33. Herein, God gives Moses some final instructions concerning the rewards that the people of Israel will enjoy if they obey, and the curses that the people will suffer if they do not obey. If you haven't read the passage, now is a good time to do so. So in today's passage, we're wrapping up God's first round of commands to Moses on Mount Sinai. Of note, despite what your film depictions may lead you to believe, Moses is going to make more than one trip up Mount Sinai. So we'll get to the other trips up the mountain another day. To conclude this first overview of the law, God gives a few final instructions. Verses 20 and 21 explain how they will receive God's further instructions as they travel through the wilderness. And the remainder of the chapter is a prophetic pronouncement of how the people will be immediately blessed if they obey God's instructions, and the blessing, in brief, is that God will overtake the promised land for them. So how will the people of Israel receive guidance in the wilderness? In verse 20, God mentions his angel, who will guard Israel in their wilderness wanderings and usher them into the promised land. We understand that this angel will give instructions to Moses. The you in the verse is a singular you referring directly to Moses and not to the whole people. And Moses, when he receives those instructions, must follow them. Now, I have no doubt that we see this angel manifested in Joshua chapter 5, just before Israel defeats Jericho. In that chapter, an angel appears to Joshua and says that he's the commander of the Lord's armies. But I am aware of no instance in these wilderness wanderings in which we see the angel of the Lord as we see him in Joshua, and particularly no instance in which we hear him give any specific instructions. This leads me to believe that the angel about whom God is speaking is manifest throughout the wilderness wanderings in the fire and cloud theophany, which we will see leading the people, purifying them, and descending on the tabernacle to communicate directly with Moses. Incidentally, we had a message focused heavily on the fire and cloud on October 15, 2017. So evidently God the Father, the first person of the Trinity, will not himself be personally appearing along the way in the wilderness. Instead, he will be sending his angel to do the work for him. Now let's not get confused about the meaning of the word angel. It does not denote a winged demigod. Angel here simply means messenger. We gather, though, that this will be no ordinary messenger. In verse 21, God says, "My name is in him." We know that there is special significance to the weight of God's name. For a deeper discussion on that, you might want to look at our message on the name of God, published July 30th, 2017. The identity of God's messenger is also hinted at in verse 22, in which we read from the NIV, "If you listen carefully to what he says and do all that I say." Clearly, the angel is acting directly as God the Father's own mouthpiece. And if it is in fact this angel who appears in the fire and cloud to descend on the tabernacle to communicate with Moses, we have indication in Exodus 33:9 that this angel is in fact Jehovah. Interestingly, it is said that Moses speaks with Jehovah face to face in the tabernacle. That, of course, is curious, because we are told that no one can see God and live. In fact, we find that verse in the very same chapter, at Exodus chapter 33, verse 20. So, this could all make for a very interesting puzzle. God says he's sending someone else to lead Israel, a messenger who bears his name and speaks as if him. Then, throughout the wilderness wanderings, we still have what appears to be Jehovah himself leading the people. And while no one can look directly on God and live, Moses speaks to this messenger face to face. Well, if you've heard our message on the angel of the Lord, published July 17, 2016, one of the old ones, of relatively low production value but still rich with valuable information, then you probably see where we're going with this. My assertion is that the person leading Israel in the wilderness and into the promised land is very much Jehovah, but not God the Father. He is instead God the Son, the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ, often called the angel of the Lord in the Old Testament, who is walking beside Israel in the wilderness and whom Moses and the other leaders of Israel see. That, it seems to me, is the only most reasonable way to interpret the facts. If God the Father is along for the journey, it is unclear how anyone looks at him and lives. If this is just some angel traveling along, it is unclear why he appears in God's signature fire and cloud theophany, and why we're told Moses spoke to God face to face. So, New Testament theology aside, we really are pigeonholed into a multi-une Godhead here. God is both not going with them and staying at Mount Sinai, and also is going with them. So, the angel is going before the people of Israel. And for what purpose is he going? Verse 20 tells us that he is going to guard the people and to bring them into the promised land. In response to this, Moses is given a command. Do what he says. Don't rebel against him. If you do, you won't be pardoned. Very serious stuff. But after that short and somber warning, we read a good many blessings that the angel will be bringing to the wandering Israelites. Verse 22 tells us that if Moses will be obedient to the angel, then God will be an enemy to Israel's enemies. Verse 23 goes on to describe that once the angel has led the people into the promised land, God will destroy its inhabitants. In verse 27, God notes that he will throw the Canaanites into terror and confusion, and that they will turn around and flee before the advancing Israelites. He promises also to send hornets to sting the Canaanites and to drive them out. Perhaps this is a metaphor, but perhaps not, judging by the plagues of Egypt. However, this destruction, we are reminded in verse 24, will not be accomplished by Jehovah alone. Rather, he will empower his people to push the Canaanites out. Particularly, Jehovah here demands that Israel break down and destroy the idolatrous pillars of the pagan people, and that they never bow down to or serve their false gods. In verses 29 through 31, we read of how this conquest will go. We are told that it won't happen suddenly overnight. It will happen gradually over the course of years. If the Canaanites were destroyed too quickly, the land would be overrun by wild animals and overgrowth that would make it not particularly usable. And besides, there would be a vacuum which more pagans would surely clamor to fill. No, God would bring his judgment on Canaan slowly and in stages, granting the people one chunk of land at a time until their land stretched from the Mediterranean to the Euphrates. God rightly saw that during this long term of warfare, the people would be tempted to make peace with Canaan, rather than fulfilling their mission of conquest. This God forbids in verses 32 and 33, noting that if there was peace between the Canaanites and the Israelites, then Canaan would become a source of temptation for Israel, leading them astray to serve false gods and to commit horrible sins. If, however, Israel will obey the angel and follow him into the land, wiping out the Canaanites as they were instructed and obeying the laws that God has given them, there will be a great blessing in it. Jumping back to verses 25 through 26, we find that the people will be blessed with good health and longevity. Particularly, God promises to bless their food and water, not at all unreasonable, seeing that they have dietary restrictions which help to ensure that food stays healthy. God promises also to take sicknesses away from them, not at all unreasonable, seeing that they have cleanliness laws from God which actually lower the risk of getting sick. That isn't to say, of course, that all sickness would completely disappear, but it will be significantly lessened for those who obey him. God promises that there will be no miscarriages or barrenness among them, and again, while such things may not disappear entirely, we've discussed before that the laws restricting certain sexual practices in Israel would also decrease the incidence of sexually transmitted diseases, which can make people infertile and cause miscarriage. All of this combined will help ensure that the Israelites live long, prosperous lives in the Promised Land. And of course, we acknowledge that while obedience to God's laws goes a long way toward giving a person a good life, God also gave miraculous protection to the people of Israel, such that, in their obedience at this time, they would perhaps experience even better results than we might experience today. Now, some question remains about whether or not the terms of this commitment were ever fully fulfilled. God promised to send his angel. He promised to drive out the Canaanites. He promised to bless the people with health and prosperity, and he promised to enlarge their borders. That promise was contingent on the command that Israel, and particularly Moses, must obey everything as instructed. Well, it's pretty obvious that Israel didn't do all that. There were problems of rebellion and sin all throughout Israel's history, and the wilderness wanderings were no exception. As we have mentioned before, Moses' failure regarding the water in the wilderness meant that he was never permitted to cross into the Promised Land. The people rebelled to such a great extent that they were not even willing to enter the Promised Land when they were first ordered to do so. So they could hardly be said to have strictly obeyed the angel leading them into battle. For this they were punished, such that none of them, save Caleb and Joshua, were permitted to enter the land, but their children did instead. Even Joshua and his men, in taking the land, made a covenant with some of the original inhabitants. So while this is a very nice promise from God, I think that we should move forward in the scriptures taking it with a grain of salt. Israel didn't hold up to their end of the bargain, so God was under no obligation to hold up his end. After many generations and hundreds of years, I think we'll see most of the promise fulfilled in a general sense. Ultimately, Israel takes the land, even if they still have to deal with their pesky neighbors. Solomon extends the borders of his kingdom a great distance, even if not for long and not quite as far as we might have hoped. And I'm sure that the people live a better life being partially obedient than they would have if they had lived and just ignored God's commands altogether. So I think that we can look at this as a situation in which Israel didn't fully obey and didn't fully get the reward. God was under no obligation to give it to them as he had listed here. But thanks be to God for his faithfulness. He still gave them very close to this and gave them significantly more than they deserved. So then, we've got our orders. For us, it was 6 months ago that the people of Israel arrived at Mount Sinai. For them, it has been maybe a few weeks at most. God has come down and revealed himself, speaking to the people his Ten Commandments. But because the people could not bear God's presence, Moses alone has gone up and received an outline of God's laws, including some major portions that we have not yet discussed, but we will not skip them permanently. God, of course, will be giving more commands as the people travel through the wilderness to the Promised Land. On the way to the land, the people will have the angel of the Lord, whom we believe to be the pre-incarnate Christ, guiding them along the way. In return for their obedience to him, the people have a promise of great rewards, including victory over their enemies, health, and longevity. Unfortunately, the people will not earn those rewards in full, but God, in his mercy, will grant their progeny most of these blessings, regardless. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.